Now we're going to look at a passage that's kind of interesting in 2 Timothy chapter 3. We have looked in the past at the trends politically, the trends economically, going toward a one-world government, getting prepared for the end times, fulfilling prophecies. But there is a lot of things morally that fit into the end times scenario. I'll never forget it was actually a part of a question, but it was part of a message that a pastor in the last century asked his congregation. Actually, it wasn't the last century because they didn't have skydivers in the last century. It was about 25 years ago. He says, how long does a skydiver have to open his parachute and once he's jumped out of the plane? And that was the question. How long does he have to open his parachute once he's jumped out of the plane? The answer is the rest of his life. Now you say, what on earth did you ask me that question for? I'll tell you. Jesus said, be alert. Watch, for you don't know what time your Lord is coming back. He'll come back like a thief in the night. And you know, if you think about it, everyone around you has the rest of their life to receive Jesus as their Lord and Savior. But you don't know how long your life will last. Of course, the parachute jumper has a limited amount of time, and yet he's got the rest of his life. Anyone has the rest of their life to follow the Lord and get their act together with God. But not knowing how long your life is, that's pretty precarious. You know, we shouldn't be surprised as we come into the last days that there will be attacks on the truth of the gospel. Jesus said, don't be surprised. Prophecies, false prophets will prophesy in my name. I haven't sent them nor commanded them. Jeremiah 14, he says, they prophesy a false vision, a divination, a worthless thing, the deceit of their own heart. You know, it's sad that when the Lord begins to do a revival and he begins to stir people up, I hear some incredible things happening down in Florida right now. Incredible things in Pensacola area where people are coming to the Lord by the hundreds. And yet, of course, associated with any move of God, there's always the extra things that come in from man. Even in Calvary Chapel's beginning, you would probably be appalled at some of the things that people tried to get away with, and, you know, all in the name of God. And Chuck Smith would sometimes say, stop that foolishness. When they get carried away in the emotion of the moment and do some weird thing or come off with some strange prophecy that did not fit the scripture, and he would exhort them, and sometimes some of them would leave and go start their own thing. And during that revival and that movement of the Lord was doing a lot of work, but so does Satan come in and try to counterfeit it. So there'll always be some weird things that go on with men if God begins to move. And it shouldn't surprise us. Jesus also said, Paul says, in the last days, the Spirit expressly says that people will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and even doctrines of demons, listening to the wrong spirit. So we need to understand this. But over all this, Paul has encouraged us. He says that Jesus said, I will build my church and the foundation of the Lord stands sure. The Lord knows who are his. But he did tell us to beware. Now, in this next part of Paul's letter to Timothy, is this last letter to Timothy before he dies. He's in prison. He'll not get out this time. He will be put to death. And so this is the last letter he'll write. And this is a real encouragement to us because, you know, this is his swan song. And, of course, he reminds Timothy again about the last days. Know this, verse 1 of chapter 3, in the last days, perilous times will come. Now, the very thing that begins here, in the first word here, but, should lead us to see the contrast of what he's talking about. He just got through talking about the servant of the Lord, gentle, able to teach, patient, in humility, these qualities that really should be a part of anyone's life seeking the Lord to serve him. So these prior statements give a contrast. Now he says, but, know this, in the last days perilous times will come. The opposite of these qualities, be careful. I remember a comedian once sharing a little bit about America's love affair with itself and how it started, how he used to portray it through the various magazines that have been published. He says, remember the magazine Life? You know, that was a broad subject. In contrast to inanimate objects, you've got Life and covers so many different things you could look at. And then a magazine came out called People. Now, People is a part of life, but it's a little bit less than all of life. People's a little more narrowed down. It's just the human part of life. And then the magazine came out, Us. Now, Us is a part of People, but now you're getting a little more narrowed down. It's just like, you know, the us and them, you know, type of thing. Us, you know, now it's just our little group. And then, of course, the magazine that's very popular, Self. Now, Self is a part of us, but you've already narrowed things down. And it's, see the trend, you know, from life in our country to eventually we got to Self. And everything revolving the self. A whole magazine written on self. Amazing. I think you could kind of throw the magazine away, just get out your mirror and you'd be fine. You know, that's all you need. Interestingly, though, this is the tendency of where we're going in this country. Notice even that Paul says, know this in the last days. Now, when he says last days, depending on the context, that can refer from any period from the time Jesus first came to his second coming, because even Paul or John wrote about these are the last days and speaking of the time he was in. When Jesus came, it was the epitome of God's love sent to this world, and that started, in a sense, the last days. So if that was the start of the last days, we're at the end of the last days, so we're really in the last days. And know this, as obviously Jesus said in the context of his teaching about the time before he would come back, that things would get worse and worse, not better and better. There's some people have a theology that the world is going to get better and better and better, and Christians are eventually going to, and they take the parable about a little leaven hidden in a meal until all was leavened, and they use that parable that a little leaven is the church, and we're going to change the whole world before the Lord comes back. They don't realize that leaven is always used as a type of sin, and the tendency is downward, not upward. And only by the grace of God does he bring us out of that natural tendency to self-centeredness. But in this period of time, Paul says, in the last days it'll be perilous times, troublous times. Jesus spoke about troublous times in reference to birth pangs when he said that that all these sorrows, all these difficulties, all these pains that would come upon the earth toward the end would be like a woman in her birth pangs. They would increase, increase, increase in frequency and in strength. And we see that as we look around us. It's happening morally too. Now, there have been various eras through church history that could be referenced to this, perilous times in church history. There were seasons. The Dark Age is a good example, when sacramentalism was replacing God. The church, the institution of man, in his power and his glory, replaced God. And it was a dark time where many true believers were put to death for their simple faith in Jesus because they did not bow down to the authorities in the church. Then rationalism came. The reason then became God. And then orthodoxism, where God was just sterile and impersonal. These things were pointed out by John Warwick Montgomery in his book called Damned Through the Church. As he points out through many church periods of history, that people have actually been led toward damnation through the results of what the church, quote unquote, visible church, was doing at that time. Incredible. And he points out politicism, where God was the state, ecumenicism, where God is an uncritical fellowship and cooperation with all nominal Christians, experimentalism, where God becomes personal experience. And finally, he said, and the most dangerous, subjectivism, where self has become God. Now, the remnants of all these isms are rampant all the way through society even today. But the last move, I think, subjectivism, is the most dangerous. Americans are increasingly, especially, moving toward that secular society mentality, even in the church. Many people are making peace with Babylon, with Vanity Fair, with the things that appeal to the creature comforts of this life. And we forget we're disciples. We forget we've been called, we've been bought out of this world with a price. Jesus paid for our life with his own blood. So Jesus spoke about perilous times, and now he describes them. And interestingly, that the evils that he describes, in many respects, is misdirected love. Love, the most powerful thing. And yet, misdirected becomes the most deadly thing. Let's look at some of these things. Love. Notice, for men will be lovers of themselves. Interesting. It's one word in the Greek. Philautos. Phileo, from which we get, brotherly love, and then autos, self. So this person has a kindly, affectionate attention and love toward himself. This is what men will become. In light of this, to me, it's very sad that even in the church, much is being done to promote self-esteem and self-love under the guise that, well, we must love ourselves before we can love our neighbor, because Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. And it's funny how people can twist Jesus' words. They twist that from the assumption of natural love that Jesus assumed. Everyone loves themselves, and you need to love your neighbor as you love yourself. You already love yourself. And they've twisted that to mean a command. The psychological community has done a great job in maneuvering that into a way where now they want you to look inside and learn how to love yourself so that you can better love someone else. And that is, to me, dangerous. We already love ourselves. We're already naturally filled with pride and conceit. And the ultimate form of pride is expressed in a person who does not get his way in life, that the ultimate form and expression of pride will be then he'll take his own life. Or he'll refuse to put up with the things in this life that are cruel or mean or hateful to him. He'll refuse to deal with the issues. He'll refuse to suffer in any respect. He'll just take his life and hurt everyone else. The ultimate form of pride. And I think that has to be seen for what it really is. But what's happened is, I think a lot of psychological thought has come into the church. A lot of these little things that people have not really thought through, they sound good, little slogans that you hear. Be careful. There was a lady in this fellowship that was going through a real severe time with part of the illness that she had, and it was affecting her emotionally in many respects. We tried ministering to her and talking with her and praying with her, but it was just a difficult time. Sometimes we just fail to realize that there are going to be things that there are no answers for from our perspective. But God knows why we go through things. Well, she had heard an advertisement, a very well-known Christian therapy program. She decided to go. She went for a period, I think it was a week or 2 weeks, and during that time, the insurance was covering it. When the insurance ran out, of course, she was dismissed as fine and as cured, as is always the case. And sadly enough, while she was there, she was pampered and treated so well, but there were a lot of things that happened there in this Christian program that she just really had a problem with. But that wasn't until she got out of it later and then went through even a worse time afterwards, because, she was so pampered and so treated so well in there. When she came back out and reality hit, it was even harder than before she went in. But then she realized that wasn't the answer. So she saw some things. There was all things from, beating on pillows and visualizing the person that you hate and beating them up. And there was, all these things, that psychological techniques that these psychologists say, well, all truth is God's truth, and we've learned these scientific methods. And I say, wait a second, where does that fit in the Bible? And I think as Christians, we have to not just sit back and listen to this stuff, because it is a very profitable thing. There are over 17,500 members of the American Association of Christian Counselors. It's swelled to that number in this country. And so many of the theories and things that people do, there's not a standard. If you go to get an operation, an appendix operation, appendix removed, a doctor follows a very specific procedure, which if he doesn't, he can be sued. He did something different and something went wrong, he could be sued. But in the psychological community, there really isn't a standard. There's hundreds and hundreds of different theories, many of them totally opposite to each other, and yet, whatever goes, it's amazing. So I think we have to be careful, especially of this tendency to love ourselves, because Jesus says in the last days, men will be lovers of themselves, and he's not speaking about this in a positive light. It's a negative light. The Bible says you shall love the Lord your God and serve him only and love your neighbor as yourself. So the focus is on your neighbor. The me-first approach to life is destructive. When you overvalue yourself, you will undervalue others around you. According to Samuel Johnson, he says, if you undervalue others, then you will eventually oppose them. So we have to be careful. Now, the second thing is very much like this. Lovers of money. Men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money. Now, this is closely associated with lovers of themselves because basically it represents the power, you know, to do whatever you would want. With, you know, you've got money now, you can do what you want. It's covetousness. Promoters of the health and wealth gospel naturally will be the forerunners of an indulgent lifestyle as well, because that's what they're promoting, supposing that godliness is a means of gain. Greed, just plain old greed is what it is. And, you know, my flesh is admittedly greedy. You know, my flesh wants things for itself. But I have to fight against those tendencies daily. I have to say no to my flesh, you know, when I want, and, you know, the desires, the eyes of man, the Bible says, are never satisfied. That's our natural tendency. We shouldn't be surprised at that. But, you see, you're not just a victim to, you know, to your feelings and your desires. You can say no. You can say, hey, I know I'm desiring this. My flesh wants that. But I'm going to wait on the Lord my God. He knows what's best. I'm not going to be so much attentive to money and things. Because really, when I get them, they don't satisfy. There's nothing that can compare with pouring your life into somebody else. No matter how much you pour your life into yourself, you'll be miserable. Now, Jesus spoke a lot about wealth and possessions when he was here on the earth. There's much teaching on that. He warned about accumulating possessions, that life consists in more than the things you possess. And it does. Now, Jesus didn't say it for any other motive. You see, as a pastor, sometimes when I talk about money, you know, people get upset because they feel there's an ulterior motive there. Jesus, of course, wasn't a fundraiser. He had no budget to meet. And he never took an offering, but the emphasis was on money a lot because he understood what it did to people. He understood the nature of it. To me, I understand that money is just another form of your time. And when you hold on to money and you hold on to that, you're just holding on for yourself. When you're generous and you let go, and you're sensitive to the needs around you. See, money is just a form of time. It, in a sense, means you're now taking your time to invest in the kingdom of heaven. I thank God for the conscientious people in this fellowship that are good stewards of what God gives them, and they give the tithe, the tenth, to the Lord's work, because they have seen a lot of things happen. I pray that more would. I know that they probably don't in this fellowship, many, because I don't emphasize much on that. I must confess I avoid the subject largely, because I know the new people coming in, you know, that's their mentality in the church. They always talk about money. So I almost go the other extreme. You know, I've got a lot of good things to talk about in the scriptures, but that is an important subject the Bible talks about many times. Be careful of being a lover of money. In the last days, people will love money. They will think of everything they get. And the sad thing is, the more you get anyway, the more greedy you are in the long run. You can never get enough. So be careful of that. Many Americans preoccupied with themselves. Billions of dollars are spent in this country on recreational and leisure pursuits. Now, there's nothing wrong with recreation. I mean, I spend money on our vacation to have a little leisure time. There's nothing wrong with that. But the problem is, when we constantly are comparing ourselves with others, people will always have more and try to live like them. We end up taking every little bit that we get and pouring it back into ourselves. And you know what? According to Haggai, when we don't put first things first, we wonder why it's like putting money into our pockets with holes in them and it just goes. It seems to never be enough. But those who have found a pleasure out of delighting and giving and being more generous, the Lord seems to always add to them. You see, when we pour our life into ourselves, we end up robbing God and robbing our children's future many times. So we have to be careful. I'll never forget one thing in one of the marriage books that I read. Charlie Shedd had said this kind of good old rural wisdom in regard to money. Giving this advice to young couples getting married, he says, good old practical wisdom is this. Give to God a tenth, save a tenth, and spend the rest freely and as you like. And I would add, on an adjusted lifestyle that fits within that 80% budget. Because you do have to adjust. You'll see people in the fellowship that can afford more than you. And it's just the nature of things. I mean, I see it all the time. I mean, we covet as people, and we have to chide ourselves and say, man, you know, just be content. Let the Lord minister to that area. You know, and in fact, as a Christian, think about it, how temporary life is in this world. One of these days, we're going to have reward that you can't even imagine. And all the stuff that we've held on to in this life will go, man, it's just dust. It's all going to burn. Think about it. That new car, that new gizmo you got for Christmas, it's going to burn when the Lord comes back. This whole physical universe is going to go up in smoke. And there is what we've spent most of our time on, i.e. most of our money, time. Be careful of being lovers of money. Then he says boasters. The word originally used for boaster in the Greek was used for a quack doctor who would wander around boasting he could cure people. And it eventually led to mean someone who just wants to talk about his own accomplishments, exaggerate his abilities, talents, you know, the kind of people that they're the hero of their own stories. I try to be careful not to do that. You know, if I'm using an illustration about, something in the Bible, I don't want to be the hero all the time because I fail many times. And I want you to know those times too. So be careful of this. But this mentality is, again, we want to put our own self first. The idea proud comes with this also in the next word, where it literally means to show oneself above, kind of a feeling of superiority. One of the funniest illustrations of this to me is in the Bible. When Haman, the advisor to the king in the time of Esther, in the book of Esther, the king had not been able to sleep one night, so he opened up these chronicles to do some reading. Figured, hey, if you want to go to sleep, just read some of the historical chronological records of the kingdom. That'll put him to sleep. So he's reading this, and he finds out there's this guy, Mordecai, that did him a great service by informing on two guys who were going to try to kill him. And he says, did I do anything for this guy? And they says, no, you didn't do anything for him. You didn't reward him or anything. And so the next day, Haman comes in, and Haman's all happy because he just built this big, huge gallows out there to hang Mordecai on. Because he hated Mordecai because he was a Jew from the country, and he did not want to bow down to the king, and he just didn't adhere to the same rules. He served God, and Haman just hated that. He had a hatred for the Jews. So he had determined a way to kill all of them. He was going to try to get it passed into law. But he just built this big, huge gallows, 75 feet high, in which to hang Mordecai on, and he couldn't wait. So he comes in, he's all happy. And the king says, Haman, what should I do for the person whom the king wants to honor? And I love what Haman says to himself. Who does the king want to honor besides me? Now, I laugh at that because that's human nature. I mean, has anybody been promoted above you and you felt that same little bit of envy just kind of creeping up slowly into your heart? And you think of all the things that you do better than they, and how come they, you know, and you go through that, and how come someone else is getting honored before me and getting attention before me? Hey, that is human nature, but Haman epitomizes that. Who would the king want to honor besides me? You know, he says to himself. And when the king tells him Mordecai, I wish I was there to see his face. That would have been so cool. Well, we know the story. Eventually, he gets hung on his own gallows. But he was proud. In the New Testament, it would be like the Pharisee who went up to the temple to pray, remember? And he spoke thus with himself in Luke 18. It's a fascinating thing. The guy goes up to the temple to pray, and the Bible says that he spoke to himself, saying, God, I thank you that I am not like this tax gatherer here, that I pay tithes of all that I own, that I do this and I do that. And he was proud in himself. And the tax collector, the publican, not Republican, but publican, said, you know, he beat himself on the breast, was not even willing to look up. He wasn't able to look up. And he just says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And Jesus said, which one do you think really went home justified? See, beware of pride. I'll tell you, it's one of the things, the Bible says of the six things the Lord hates, pride is at the top of the list in Proverbs chapter 6. Pride is deadly. The most difficult thing is, when you've got it, to try to get rid of it. It's very difficult because then you'll be proud of how humble you're trying to be. It's deadly. Hey, I know some of the secret chastenings of the Lord in my own experience enough to, it's like helped me a lot because I know what it's like to be on the shelf, to be unused of the Lord, to be wallowing in my own self and, oh, Lord, keep me humble. I never want to be on the shelf again. Pride. But in the last days, there'll be boasters, proud, blasphemers. Word here simply means contemptuous and a mocker of good. Disobedient to parents. Pretty self-explanatory. Now, in those days, in the Roman law even, you would break the law if you struck or even rebelled against your parents. To hit your father was as bad as murder in Roman law. Amazing, even in that culture. But you know what I think in our culture, because of the disappearance in many respects of mothers at home, the self-love that's promoted in the classroom and in society, the unwillingness to punish perpetrators of violence, has led to this ever more prevailing rebellion against any authority. And it's a tragic thing, but it's like a tidal wave that's going to knock this country over. If something doesn't happen, if revival doesn't come. And it begins with that disobedience to parents. Then he goes into what I call the uns, the unthankful, the sin of ingratitude, the unholy, the unloving. No natural affection in the Greek. The word storge is a love. It's a different word for love, for just natural affection. In this time, they'll have no natural affection. What do you see constantly in the newspaper? Some little baby has been born and left to die in some garbage bin or has been murdered or, you know, and you see a lot more of that. Now, it's natural affection a mother would have for her own child. But in this society, in this growing self-centered society that I want what I want when I want it and I don't want anything to get in my way, doesn't matter who you kill, who you put out of the way. No natural affection. This also goes to divorce is a form of violence. Now, I know many of you in this fellowship have been divorced through prior relationships before you came to the Lord, and some of you even after you came to the Lord. And you know, but I'll tell you, divorce is a result of sin. Some sin somewhere along the line. It's not God's design. Of course, God is merciful and forgiving, but I'll tell you, it is a very tough thing to go through. Be careful. Your heart can get so hardened. And then he goes on, the unforgiving. You know, we know the importance of forgiveness. Jesus even said, if you're unwilling to forgive your brother, then your heavenly Father won't forgive you. Because if you've been forgiven of $1 million in debt, so to speak, you know, spiritually speaking, and you're unwilling to forgive a few dollars that someone owes you, some wrong they've done to you, which in comparison to your sin is nothing, then you've missed the whole point of forgiveness. So I call these the uns. He even goes on just in a different way. Slanderers, which would be the ungracious, the malicious gossips who love to build their reputation on the ruins of others. The same word slander, in fact, is diabolos, which we get the word devil, which means slanderer. Without self-control, so no self-control, I can say uncontrolled. You know, it's amazing how we've, in our society, we're glorying in shame. I picture these freak shows on TV. You know the talk shows? I call them the freak shows because they get... It is. It's like a circus side act. You get some of the strangest characters out there who have the weirdest experiences, the most unnatural, far out, you know, just weird people, and you display them. And these people, for money, will get on national television and glory in their shame. Things they ought to be ashamed of. They're reveling in. Amazing. We're seeing more of that. Brutal. I'd say ungentle. Self-love, unchecked, leads to insensitivity to others. Despisers of good. Haters of good here. Isaiah chapter 5, if you did your reading in the new schedule, you'd be in Isaiah chapter 5 today, and you would have found the different woes. Woe unto men who do this, this, and this. And interestingly enough, in that set of woes is woe to those who call evil good and good evil. And our society's good at that. You know, they can twist things around and make a person that's really a perpetrator of a crime a victim. And they can switch it around and make the victim appear the criminal. And they can call good evil in many different respects. I mean, this isn't just like we did in the 60s when we'd say, oh, that's really bad, man, meaning good, you know. This is reality. This is what people are doing as they twist the truth. Haters of good. Notice, traitors, unloyal. There were those in those days that would even turn Christians into Rome. And Jesus predicted that in the last days, brother would deliver up brother to death, and father his child, and children would rise up against parents, cause them to be put to death. Headstrong, uncongenial, I'd say. Reckless, careless, negligent, so preoccupied with your own interests that you don't really take notice of others. I'll never forget an episode on the People's Court. This guy that Judge Wapner was in the case was so arrogant. I thought Judge Wapner was going to turn 100 shades of red and hit him with something. But this guy was so smug and so haughty, headstrong, just this proudful attitude. He was like so, I don't know how to describe it, but Judge Wapner, after he was done, he says, you know, he had to give the guy his way because according to the law, the guy was right. But Judge Wapner says, man, I hope one day you run into somebody that puts you in your place. And he was livid at this guy. But you know, that's the blind arrogance and haughtiness of some people filled with conceit. It's becoming more and more frequent. And then he goes, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. The unlovers of God. So, you know, the interesting thing is all these uns. This is really a description of mankind apart from God. He's undone. He's half-baked. He really doesn't have the qualities. You see, every evil quality is a perversion of good. It's an absence of good. You know, that's why this whole concept of dualism never would really fit in the world. The concept does not answer life. You know how you have, you know, eternal good and eternal evil battling it out as people trying to explain the universe? You know, the yin-yang thing that you'll see sometimes in advertisements. You know, the idea of eternal good and eternal evil, it doesn't make sense because evil doesn't have any definition apart from good. Evil is the absence of good. Good, evil could not exist if it weren't for what good is in its state. But because good is, then evil comes along and it's an absence of good. And see, this is what happened at the fall. When man fell in sin, he went toward himself. He chose independently of God. This is what happened to the nature of man. This is the natural tendency without God. Now, we try to unlearn a lot of this stuff. We learn manners when we're children. We learn how to respect others. We can learn a semblance of qualities that can make us at least appear that we're good. And then some guy will come along and say, well, man is basically good. No, that's not true. He'll act basically good because the consequences of being evil, many times he's afraid of the consequences of losing friends or putting put in jail, depending on what the thing he did is. But naturally, if he could get away with anything, he'd naturally tend toward these things. This is natural man. This is a good portrait of ourselves apart from God, if we're willing to admit it. The interesting thing is, this is man. The number of the man is 6. You'll see this over time. You know, of course, we get hung up on the 666, you know, the number of man in Revelation. What's the number? Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast. And his number is 666. Well, that to me is the perfection of man in his undone state. See, because 7 is completion, 7 days in a week. It's completion and perfection. It's the number of God in that sense. 6 is the number of man. He just hasn't quite got it. He's unloving. He's unholy. He's unthankful. He's unforgiving. Uncontrollable. Uncongenial. Ungracious. This is the natural tendency. And notice verse 5. Having a form of godliness, but denying its power, and from such people turn away. Now this is the epitome of this in the church. Because this is what he's referring to. Be careful in the last days. This isn't just the people outside. This is the people in the church. Having a form of godliness, the outer shape of godliness, the appearance. Ooh, I'm a Christian. I'm godly. But only concerned with the outer appearance so as to take advantage of those unsuspecting where it becomes just mere self-interest. You know, here's the real problem. What to do with such people? avoid them. The middle present tense verb means to avoid and make yourself avoid and continue to make yourself avoid such people as this. You know, sometimes these people that have some of these qualities are in the most popular group. When they have kind of a conscience that's not bothered by the little scruples that other people are bothered with, and they kind of can be free, no inhibitions, and, you know, they can do whatever they want, and they can say things with impunity and ha 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 afterwards. And sometimes people are honored in this capacity. I know in Hollywood, in many respects, the smart mouth, you know, can say anything to anybody. That's cool in Hollywood. And I have to admit that my flesh loves certain comedians and certain actors that have that persona. It's funny to look at and to laugh at. But in the church, in reality, in real life relationships, it doesn't have its place. From such people turn away. You see why? For of this sort, there are those who creep into households and make captives of gullible women loaded down with sins, led away by various lusts. Now, just by illustration, I would say they would take advantage of the weak. That's exactly what they would do. They'll take advantage of the especially vulnerable and weak people. And they're attracted to people who are weak and have difficulties. Person that's loaded down with sins, has a guilt complex, makes them especially susceptible. Person very sensitive in conscience. And one of these guys with impunity can come in and totally take advantage. You know, be careful. It can happen in the church. People come to the church sometimes without even knowing it themselves, but they're not there to serve God. They're not there to seek God. They're there to find a person that can meet their needs. They're there to have somebody meet their needs, and to some degree, they'll do whatever they can. They'll say the right words. They'll raise their hands, praise the Lord. But you don't know where their hearts are at. Be careful. Now, they're ever learning, he goes on to say, always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Interesting picture here. As he goes on and describes, Jannes and Jambres resisted Moses. Now, in the Old Testament, Jannes and Jambres aren't mentioned, but they're mentioned in the Jewish traditions. And Paul quotes these as these, it's believed that they were the two magicians that withstood Moses in the time of Pharaoh. Interesting thing is, they were resisting the truth. Moses was coming, let my people go, and he gave a sign, you know, threw the staff down and became a serpent. So what did they do? The first thing they did was they counterfeited exactly what he did. They threw their staffs down and they became snakes, but it was a counterfeit. So they looked and appeared to be just as powerful as Moses. The only thing is that Moses' snake and staff ate up their snakes and staffs. But Pharaoh's heart was hardened. The next thing they couldn't fake it. When finally got to the one sign that Moses came in when he turned the dust into lice, they tried, but they couldn't do it. And they realized, wait a minute, we're out of our league. This is the finger of God. So they couldn't fake it at one point. And eventually, they finally suffered as a result of when Moses, you know, brought the curse on, and God brought the curse where boils came upon all the people. Even the magicians couldn't even stand before Pharaoh because they were in such pain. So to me, it's an interesting thing. These guys resisted the truth. Men of corrupt minds disapproved concerning the faith. But they will progress no further, for their folly will be manifest to all, as theirs also was. You see, theirs eventually was manifest that they were wrong. And it's true in this sense. One day, where a person is at, where their heart is at, which many times we can't judge, we don't know. We can only see the outside. But where they're at eventually will be manifest. But in the meantime, you beware. You beware and you avoid such. See, and that's the key. From such people turn away. Now, are the people that you are around in the church of this nature? Then avoid them. Now, some people will think, oh man, that's pretty harsh. You know, if a person's doing these things, it's just totally harsh. It's unloving to cut them off. Hey, it's the best thing for them. But don't listen to people that will try to appeal to that. You know, there's sometimes people that are great at manipulating. They'll find a Christian, and you know, you realize we're very susceptible sometimes to appeals that come in through the mail. Soon as you help one organization, you know, they'll sell your name to 100 other organizations, And they'll pay good money for your name. They'll pay sometimes a couple of dollars for each of the names that the organization will send them, because you've already shown that you're sensitive in conscience to someone in need. What that happens is eventually these lists get sold to people who are just charlatans, and they know how to write those letters up. Dear Alice, I was thinking about you today and wondering what I could pray for you about. But we have this need right now in our ministry, and unless something happens, you know, God is going to take my life, you know, or whatever message they have. And, you know, they'll have some slick way, or they'll capitalize in some disaster when they have nothing to do to help that disaster. To be honest with you, most of the mail that I get, I just throw in the garbage. I don't even open a lot of it when it comes from organizations that I can tell, oh, how did they get my address? And I know how they got my address, and I just chuck it. You know, I'd rather see the need that is real around me, and I'd rather help that need that I can see and I can touch. And when they're in the news, there is a valid need that we can have a part to minister, such as the refugees in Yugoslavia or the orphanages in Russia. Hey, we've got plenty of them just that we know for a fact are doing a good work. So be careful how you can be susceptible to these things. But I'll tell you, we are. Or if there's someone that you meet that's very good at manipulating, and you realize you're being manipulated, and you say, look, I'm not going to help you anymore. And they'll say, oh, you Christians, you know, are all alike. And they lay the guilt trip on you. You know, when they start doing that, I just laugh because it's funny to me. I've been there. I've seen it. Don't be manipulated by people. True love does what's good for someone. And if you need to cut them off because that's good for them, you should rejoice in that and not feel any guilt. The other side of that is be careful, because they'll go from that person who they've exhausted resources, they've totally used them, and they'll find somebody else in the church that doesn't know anything about them. And they'll say things like, you know, you're a lot more spiritual than those other Christians over there. You're a lot more sensitive to people's needs. I really appreciate you. You're different. I can sense Jesus in you. Oh, if you ever hear that, just puke all over the person. You know? What I'm saying is that, you know, Jesus, didn't he say that we're to be wise as serpents and gentle as doves? We're to be shrewd. We should be shrewd. We really should have our, you know, our eyes looking a little closely at situations and not just accept what someone says at face value. You know, it's funny, when we go to Israel, we have to tell people, you know, and usually one of the orientations is, you know, the tour guide will say, now look, you're in a foreign country, and you're excited, you're in the Holy Land, and you're excited about being here, but don't do here what you wouldn't do at home. In other words, would you go out at 2 a.m, walking down a strange street, you know, is if you wouldn't do that at home, then don't do it here, because there are people here that will take advantage of you. And, you know, would you get into a stranger's car? You know, some guy comes up and tells you they're a tour guide and they've got some special sights to show you. Would you get in their car? Because sometimes people go over there and they get naive, you know. Oh, I'm in the Holy Land. And they'll hop into a car with some stranger. Or this guy at the hotel will be really suave and cool and, you know, dressed to kill. And he comes up and he's like, you know, paying attention to the ladies. And, you know, hey, you can't do there what you wouldn't do here too if you don't know the person. So there has to be a sensibility here. And I don't know how I got off on the subject, but I think it just comes down to this. They're good. These guys are good at manipulating, but they're really never going to come to the truth. And be careful of being manipulated. They're men of corrupt minds. They resist the truth. They can't understand the truth, and they counterfeit the truth, disapprove concerning the faith. But they'll progress no further. But just don't you become a victim. In this respect, be wise. Help those needs. When you really know a need, then your heart should go out to that when it's a valid need. But there should be a sense not to be suspicious in everything. You know, Spurgeon helped me out on that. He says, I would rather be deceived 100 times than live a life of suspicion. And you don't want to be that. You don't want to be suspicious of everything, you know, and critical and analyzing and the whole thing. But just be wise, be shrewd. And you'll do well. But their folly, they'll be manifest to all eventually. One thing is certain, time will tell. And we're not going to go into the next verses, but just if you notice the contrast real quick. He says, but you have carefully followed my doctrine, manner of life, and purpose. We'll see how that all fits together next time. Faith, long-suffering, love, and perseverance. And then he describes his own personal experiences and his personal testimony and what he went through. But this is an illustration for all of us.